it's tough being an Australian judoka, but it's also made me the person that I am.
Welcome to the Judo Edit podcast, where I chat with judo athletes, coaches, and influential people to bring you a glimpse into the behind the scenes of the international judo circuit. Hopefully, you can find something that will make your judo better. On this episode, we'll be continuing Oren Yaniv's story as an athlete in part one, but also outlining how he applies these principles into what he believes are the best methods towards mastery, what he would change of his competition days, and how he also uses judo as a philosophy for life. So, sit back and enjoy. When you retired from your competitive career,
yeah,
it took you a little while to reorient yourself to be like, yes, I'm going to start this club. What was that process in order to become not just a competitor, but also a coach or someone who is teaching judo?
Yeah, so it's I'm still in that transition. It's not clear yet, and I don't know necessarily where I fit into it all. I know that I'm transitioning out of competition, and I'm not saying that I'm against competition, and I'm not saying I'm against returning to competition, but if I do return to competition, it's only for, unfortunately, the constraints of grading. If I want to get my third done, I need the points. So, you know, just to make that clear, I'm not going to, people are going to see me again and I'm going to give some people some grief again in the 81 kilo class. Oh, yes. Yeah. So look, that transition has been, it's been a funny one. I mean, I sleep at night knowing that at least I got to compete with the best in the world. I'm very proud of that. And I got that taste. I got thrown into coaching initially by accident. I took on a coaching role. I was sort of assisting a club coaching. And then when that coach had to move on to other things, I kind of filled that role. And so, you know, I felt it was my obligation to sort of continue it. And there were some good students there. It's where I met my girlfriend Yvonne at that club. And, you know, she was a really dedicated student. And so I continued sort of coaching that group. And through that process, along with starting to do a few personal training sessions and teaching some one-on-ones, I had this really wonderful exposure to sort of teaching that at the end of the day was initially for selfish reasons. I wanted to continue it because I saw my judo improving. When you have to teach something, you know, and I've got a, you know, a quote, to teach is to learn twice. And I think that it's been such a valuable thing, and I kind of want to keep that ball rolling. So, well, I mean, that was the initial motivation, is I wanted to keep this teaching or coaching, and maybe, look, I don't want to say teaching and coaching because they are different things, and I'm maybe not a coach yet, but at the moment I'm a teacher, and I'm a teacher by trade. And yeah, I feel that having that opportunity to provide that information and teach someone, it just really reinforces your own learning. I'm keeping that ball rolling, and that's led me to sort of start a club. And yeah, I think it's experimental, but I'm really excited. I'm very confident that it's going to go well.
In terms of your club, what is different about the approach that you're bringing to teaching as opposed to the clubs that you've trained at previously?
Yeah, look, at Judo Matsu was a club, and you know, a little bit of the context of the name is that Matsu is actually pine tree, which is the meaning of my name, Oren. Oren is Hebrew for pine tree. Matsu is Japanese for pine tree. And at the end of the day, like, what a tree stands for, excuse the pun, but it means a lot to me. It's got a strength, it's got a root system. I still remember when I asked my dad, why did he call me Oren? He said, pine trees have strong roots. And I really sort of embraced that in different ways over the years. But right now, I embrace it that there's a connection and there's something that goes deeper. It's what sort of holds us together. And yeah, like, I can go on about like all these sort of tree analogies. The point is that I've gravitated towards the martial art component of judo. What I mean by that is that there was probably a point there where I was looking for something. I was looking for something deeper than what I was experiencing in judo. And I was quite close to moving to Aikido. Aikido is what my dad does. He's a seventh dan. He's kind of really the Australian representative in the sport, in the martial art. And look, Aikido, you know, people have a lot of ideas about it. I can honestly say I highly respect it. I've seen it at such a high end. But it wasn't until I kind of started teaching and having people show me different things and me sort of doing more research into judo that I discovered that there's a real martial art side of judo as well. And it's very close to what Aikido is.
Yeah. And so hold on a second. Yeah. So delineate for everyone who is just used to competition judo. What,
yeah.
What defines competition judo from the martial art that you're now looking at?
All right, so I think competition has been a very valuable part of my life, but what competition has done to judo, and this is just my personal take on it, is that when there is this kind of result or prestige attached to something, it drives people and nations just towards that, and it sort of turns into this whole thing of like just win or just that success. And I feel as though that the sport's in some ways been diluted because of that pursuit. I feel that nations will push, you know, the athletes to just get so much more physical than the rest to kind of win the competition. And I think that the throws and the movements and the things that people are pulling off in this high level, it's not what the general population or what judo once was. It's hard for me to explain, but I think that, look, competition has its place, and, you know, like I said, it was very valuable to me, but I feel as though it's kind of, because of competition, judo at its sort of essence or its kind of real starting point, it's kind of been lost. And right. I think the martial arts side of that is to re-explore what judo and what the gentle way is really about.
Just as a point off that, when you mentioned that judo at its origin, when Jigoro Kano started it back in 1882, if we were to transplant him from 1882 into today's sort of world and take the best of that time period against today's competitive judo, do you think that the 1882 judo, the pure judo, would stand a chance against like physical aggression that we see nowadays?
No, it's a valuable point. I mean, well, look, I mean, I'm not a massive driver for leg grabs, but I know a lot are. But, you know, the reality is that leg grabs and like a lot of these techniques were once part of judo and now they're not. Mm-hmm. People would argue that judo is not as effective because it doesn't have them, particularly in the jiu-jitsu world. But the point is that I don't think judo was ever intended to have this high-end competition. And now this is all up for, you know, everyone's own, you know, everyone's got their own personal take on it all. But for my understanding, judo was initially an art to fix a problem that was starting to resonate in Japan. And it was, my understanding, it was actually a rule set for people to live by.
Okay.
If we break down what the rules or the philosophy, not the philosophies,
principles
of judo are, why is there principles such as courtesy and friendship in that set? And it's because that it's about forming good people. And I think Kano felt as though that Japan was losing its, a lot of its kind of history and its martial art history, which is so embedded into the culture. And so he started something that people could practice and through that practice could become better people.
Yeah.
And competition was never originally part of that practice.
Right.
Not to misunderstand me that, but randori and competition are different. Randori is a very important tool in judo and it's something that we should all be doing, but it's for ourselves. Randori is our personal competition. There's no kind of winning or losing per se. There's not that kind of drama or vulnerability or costs or prestige associated with it. Yeah, you have your own kind of win against that person, but generally in a randori, that person's getting straight back up and he throws you. So, you know, it's not like a competition where it's over and, you know, so quickly. But it's a place for us to practice our techniques that we've been working so hard on. And I think that the competition side of judo really happened, and why the Olympics took on judo and why Kano allowed that to happen was more for the longevity of the art rather than what he really wanted.
Okay.
And look, that's my personal take. I've had discussions with people. What I guess I'm trying to start with judo matsu is that the satisfaction on beating yourself is far better than beating someone else. And, you know, I had to go through competition and beat others and to also lose and be beaten to understand that. But That's more of the concept that's sort of within Aikido, is that the competition's with yourself. And in other martial arts, that would sort of say that. And I'm learning that. And it's not to dilute all the practice and all the hard work that I've done.
Yeah.
It's actually to reinforce that. So I can still go and practice Uchimata, my favorite technique, like crazy. But the reason I'm doing it is to then see if I can pull that off in a randori.
Sure.
And to me, if I was, you know, example, if I was to practice Uchimata day in, day out, and then I was to launch in and throw a really strong competitor in randori, that's enough. You know, that solidifies that you're doing the right thing.
Mm.
And that's what randori is about. And that's what I believe the gentle way is about, is to be able to throw someone and take control of that person for that few seconds and give yourself that feedback that that was the right thing. And then they get back up. And, you know, and it starts again. And it's a game, you know, it's an opportunity to explore, you know, a game with all your sort of techniques and skills and enjoy that.
You know what this really reminds me of when you speak of it in this way? It actually reminds me a lot of surfing, how there's, you know, people who are so amazing at surfing, but they're just in it for the feeling, for the appreciation of the wave.
Yeah, like, well, we've got to get a surf. We've got to get out surfing. To you and I, we've been saying that for a while. So,
I mean, I haven't surfed ages. Are you still surfing?
Yeah, still surfing. I mean, and that's been, I tell you what, that's been a hard process. I don't think there's anything that's come close to the difficulty with judo, but surfing's definitely up there.
Yeah.
Like you said, and that's what surfing's about. Like, you can obviously be competitive with surfing and compete against others, but really, at the end of the day, why, you know, I'd speak to my mate. The reason Simo, my mate's going out surfing all the time, is for himself. It's not for anyone else. He's just going there because that's his, you know, that's his cleanse, that's his detox. And for me, that's what judo is. And, you know, we talked about it earlier about how it humbles you. I think it's really important to, you know, have the randori aspect, but you don't need to be regarded as a great judoka thinking that if you haven't competed either. You know, I've heard stories, which I hang on to, that some of the best players in the world don't compete.
Especially out of Japan.
In Japan and in Brazil.
Yeah.
I'm told that Chibana, the 60, 66 kilo Chibana, his brother is actually far better than he was.
Really?
And he just doesn't compete. And then, you know, on that whole sort of topic, someone said to me recently, which really resonated with me, is that I was sort of talking to him about my sort of transition to coaching and where I sort of want to go. And he said to me, well, you know that masters don't compete.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know what? Yeah, one day I would like to be a master. And the reality is that does not go hand in hand with competition.
Yeah.
And then he said to me straight afterwards, generals don't go to war. And I thought, wow, you know what? That's just, I mean, for me, that really hit home. It's like, I've had my battles, you know, and yeah, I've lost a lot. You know, I've lost most of my battles internationally. But at the end of the day, I've had that experience of the battles.
Mm-hmm.
And why not, you know, sit on top right now and look at it from a strategy perspective and look at it from a deeper level. And, you know, I don't have to do that hard work now and put myself through those battles. I can, you know, I can just learn and master skills and look at it from just a broader perspective than just competition.
Yeah.
And I think that that's the transition that I would like to move to.
At the same time, do you think that it's possible to take that sort of approach and mindset that you've got in terms of beating yourself, being better than yourself, training every day with that intention as a competitor, and have that be enough of a driving force to succeed at a competitive level?
So you're saying not competing?
Say you're 25 and you're still competing, still trying to make the Olympics, but instead of having your motivation being, I need to beat this person, I need to be number one in Australia, and having specific people in mind, you're purely focusing on yourself and improving yourself as a driving factor behind your competitive career.
Yeah, to answer your question, I think so. I think it's not the easy path.
Yeah.
And an example of that would be, I'm not going to stereotype nations on how their approach is, but let's just say it. Some nations create a plan which might be specific to a certain competitor that they're going to fight with. So you've got, you know, in my class, 73 kilos, you're going to come up against this person. You make a plan on how to beat that person.
Mm.
That might be the strategy and that might be the goal. My philosophy is that if you wipe all of that and actually just focus on yourself and focus on your own techniques, it's going to take a little bit longer, but eventually you form a feeling to your fights. You rely more on dealing with any situation that comes to you. It's hard for me to explain. How can I say it better?
You're saying that you build out your level of ability and the strategy sits on top of that as a secondary trait?
Yeah, I would say that you shouldn't train towards a particular person. I think that, look, within your own personal training, it should be to kind of broaden your skill set. So it's not kind of like just practice one thing. You're creating a skill set that should be learning to deal with multiple situations. And that kind of reinforces the whole idea of a martial art. The difference between judo as a sport versus as a martial art is often people who are competing in the sport will only learn a handful of moves that are going to bring, you know, the win. And unfortunately, if those moves don't work, you'll lose. Versus if you're a martial artist, your job is to cover the whole thing. And so when you look at judo as an art form, you look at practicing all of the aspects. And that means all throws. What that allows you to do when you open yourself up to that is that you may come across an opportunity, and because you're practicing it in a more holistic way, you'll have a better answer to that opportunity.
I suppose going off this methodology, is your club still going to have elements of a competitive aspect, or are you going to purely sort of focus on the art form?
Look, at the end of the day, and this is all very new to me, like becoming a sort of, you know, creating a club, becoming a business owner, it's a product at the end of the day that I'm trying to deliver, and people are coming for different reasons. And, you know, there's going to be people that are coming because they genuinely want to compete in judo. They're very fascinated by that and want to go through it. Others might come because they want to learn some self-defense. Others might come because they just, you know, like exploring different movements and things like that. So people are coming to judo for lots of different reasons, and I've got to cater towards that.
Yeah.
If I was to kind of give my take on what I would kind of implement for a competitor, it would be following the lines of that at the end of the day, we're doing a sport. It's an action-reaction based game. And my advice to them and what I would be teaching them is the fact that we need to create action in order to get a reaction.
Yeah.
And then we need to practice a whole bunch of movements and throws and whatever it is to answer that reaction.
Yeah.
And that's really part of my philosophy. If they want to go that way, if they want to compete, and how they could go about beating someone else is you need to elicit that reaction.
Yeah.
Today, I think the best way of doing that, because I can't slap my opponent, is Uchimata. To me, I think it is the pinnacle of all throws, and along with the fact that the judo club means pine tree.
Yeah.
I've got a tree analogy to go along with Uchimata, which I'll share with you. It's pretty funny.
Explain the tree analogy.
So the way I see it is, remembering that it's an action-reaction based game, is that Uchimata, and the search of Uchimata is a threatening one. The stance that it requires, the grip that it requires, it's a very neutral stance and it's a very neutral grip.
So you're going from standard, right?
Standard lapel, Japanese lapel sleeve.
Yeah.
And to do Uchimata properly, and there's a lot of people doing Uchimata very differently, so you'd have to see the way I do mine. It's a bit different. But imagine I'm trying to sort of put in my hip and try to sort of get that into the midline of your body.
Yeah.
That sort of chase or pursuit of doing that is going to get a reaction from your opponent. And so I call Uchimata the trunk of the tree. Mm-hmm. It's the throw that goes straight through the middle of your opponent, like a trunk goes straight up. But what tends to happen is if your opponent reads that Uchimata is coming, they're going to respond in a certain way. And they're either going to kind of take maybe a jigatai position, or they're going to jump to the left, jump to the right. They're going to kind of stiffen up in different areas to defend. And each one of those positions has a throw you can answer with. And a jigatai position might be Ouchigari. So they're leaning back. Ouchigari is the answer to that. It may be a Kouchigari. If they sort of jump off it, it might be following up with a Harai-goshi or an Osotogari. And then so all of a sudden you have all of these throws that are coming your way just from the search of Uchimata. So I'm calling those other throws branches off the trunk, which are branches off Uchimata. And I believe that The Japanese understand this concept really well, and that's why I think all of them practice uchimata. And the reason for it is that it sets a very neutral stance. A lot of throws can be done from the same position, and it's threatening because of that. If you talk about strategy and you talk about competition, even Randori, which I'm, you know, obviously a big fan of, that's my approach to that.
That's so interesting, because when you used to be a competitor, was your tokuyu was a Tayotoshi.
Mm.
So if you could then go back, would you change the way you fought?
Oh, 100%. Yeah, definitely.
And what would you change?
Look, Tayotoshi was definitely my favourite throw for a while, and it came from the fact that I threw a really, really good person in my eyes back when I was a lot younger with it very easily. And it then was like reinforcing the fact that maybe I should practice this and get it even better, because then I'll throw even better people with it. The thing about Tayotoshi is that it is, again, it's a branch off the tree. And I don't feel it's got other branches that come off that too much.
So you mean there's not many other combinations you can go out of it or...
Yeah, so Tayotoshi, when you kind of really go in wholehearted with Tayotoshi, there's not too many, if it doesn't work and your opponent responds and gets out of it, there's not too many directions that you can go afterwards. Mm-hmm. I was reasonably competitive with a combination afterwards, but it's now been taken out because it was a leg grab. Mm-hmm. It's, I would call, and you know, Matt Taquino actually gave me that kind of word for it, but there's some throws that you'd consider more full stops. And then there's other throws that you would consider like commas. Mm. And Tayotoshi is more along the lines of being a full stop. It's kind of something that you kind of finish with.
Yeah.
Uchimata, you know, definitely got more to go along with, you know, and then there's, you know, there's other throws as well that are going to give you more ways out.
What are some of the other throws, just out of interest?
So, I mean, Osotogari gives you a little bit more. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a few other sweeps, foot sweeps that can go after Osotogari.
Yeah.
Haragoshi, any of the hip throws will give you a little bit more.
Sure.
Because they're a little bit more neutral in the center. But I would say throws like Sienagi, Tayotoshi tend to be kind of the outer branches.
Right.
They don't, okay. I mean, Ippon Sienagi, people, you know, have got a bit of a Kouchigari or Gak or Makikomi off that. But again,
it's very difficult to get out of it because you've changed your grip completely.
Yeah, it just doesn't have too much that can follow. So my advice, and it's the same with the ground, and I'm not, you know, fantastic on the ground. I'd like to be a lot better. But again, my approach to the ground would be looking at techniques that are very general. General, and the other thing that I like about the ground is techniques that are a little bit more subtle. Techniques that don't show the situation that you're going for, but, you know, have multiple situations you can go for.
And again, I suppose I'm thinking from a competitor's point of view, but is there a trade-off between having something that's subtle because you're setting it up, like, in a subtle manner, while you're running the risk of the referee not realising that you're setting it up and potentially calling mate?
Yeah, that's a fair point. I mean, the reality is, yeah, we do have time constraints to the ground. And when I say subtle, it's more, it's still got to have, in a judo context, it's still got to have a kind of a power and an explosion about it, even though it's subtle.
Yeah.
Subtle is in, like, you take a grip on someone and they don't know exactly what you're doing versus you go straight in for a jujitsu-katami and they're going to know what's coming. Or you go Sangaku, they know straight away that it's going to be Sangaku.
Do you see Niwaza from like a more positional perspective rather than a straight turnover or hold down perspective?
Yeah. Where I'm at today, I'm encouraging a lot more of a position. I lost too many fights focusing on the final outcome.
Yeah.
And that was because I didn't secure the position before the submission.
Mm-hmm.
I was trying to secure the submission way too early, and that lost me a lot of fights.
So how would you sort of teach that now in terms of if you've got a fresh white belt in your club?
It would be taking, again, a general subtle position and learning to read.
That's an example of a subtle position.
So that might literally be, so say someone's in turtle, you've just got a lapel. Mm-hmm. So you've come over and you've got a lapel, mm-hmm. or you've got one sort of foot in as a hook,
mm-hmm.
and you've got multiple directions that you can go, or you have then your opponent reacting to that, then you follow up from that. So you're kind of more in touch with how your opponent's moving rather than forcing an opponent forcing a position. And it's the same with standing. Is like my approach now is you take a strong position and you have your little kind of movements and, you know, little side steps and cross steps and a little bit of footwork, foot sweeps, grip changes and stuff like that, all to elicit a reaction.
Yeah.
And then you play off that.
Yeah.
I give the analogy, it's like poker. You know, you've got these cards. I know guys that play the high level, and we often talk about the similarities. And those similarities are that at the end of the day, it's not about how good your cards are. Mm-hmm. It's about how you can read reaction. And I think that is really at the crux of what good judo is about as well.
Yeah.
About what all good athletes, you know, in all sports are good at is they're able to read reaction or anticipate or adjust to the situation. And that's what I would encourage. So you want to be able to get a reaction and then have an ability to read that reaction and answer it.
Given the amount of time we have to train is much more restricted than what they have in Japan, for example, how do you develop something like reading reactions very well within a short amount of time?
Yeah, look, it's a good question. It's something that I'm still trying to deal with myself. I mean, the reality is we don't have a culture of the training that is in Japan. And I mean culture because in Japan it is a culture. It's supported by the family. It's supported by the school. It's supported by everyone around you. Yeah, by the workplaces. We just don't have that.
So is it more like you'd have to spend more time actually doing drills or most of the time doing randori?
I would say it's a combination of both, but I would say that the randori needs to be one that is being pulled back a little bit. So it might be, say, a 70 or 80% randori. And the reason for that is that you don't have the stiffness or the strength component coming in, and you don't have this kind of, and it's very particular to Australia, I think, that we've got this kind of quite stiff judo. Okay. I think overseas it's a little bit more movement based. I mean, don't misunderstand me, they're very strong and rigid in times. But, you know, I think of a world of judo that I've come across in Brazil while I was there, where there's a coach that will whack you with a stick if you move in the same direction too many times or if you stiffen up or use strength. Mm. I would 100% encourage my students to, you know, and it's funny because it was the exact opposite of what originally my motivations were, which was strength and speed. You know, I want to throw my opponent with more strength and more speed. I want to not use any of them. I want to throw by timing. I want to throw with purely finding the right position and throwing them easily. I mean, judo has multiple meanings to different people. For me, gentle way, soft way, it's throwing your opponent in the most efficient possible way, not using strength or power.
Is there a competitor on the world scene at the moment who could say that you sort of uphold as a good example of that?
I admire a few players. My favourite player at the moment would have to be Ono. It's not so much that he's playing. I mean, he's probably incredibly strong. He actually is incredibly strong because I fought with him. And there's a nice little doco about him talking about how incredibly strong he is as well. But what I admire about his judo is his commitment to throws. Again, he's an Uchimata player. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the other throws that he throws with, they're just movements off Uchimata. So that's why I admire his judo, is because, again, he's following the Uchimata principle that I spoke about. And he also has a beautiful Uchimata. It's the way that I would like to do Uchimata. Mm-hmm. As far as feelings concerned, and I would say Nagase has got a really nice take on judo, where he doesn't have a structure or a physicality like a lot of the other players in the 81 kilo division. Mm-hmm. He is strong, don't misunderstand me, physically, but his feeling is really what's special. And if you watch his judo, he will just knock you over with what's necessary. He won't overdo it. He won't use excessive strength or force when he doesn't need to. And I think that that's what good judo looks like. The same would probably be Matsumoto. I think that her feeling, like you look at her on the ground, the way she wins is it's the mistake of the other person.
Yeah.
And I think there's something very special in that. It's like, create all this action to get a reaction, which could be a mistake, and then punish them for it, you know? And that's good judo.
Yeah.
Is that they've got the feeling, they're holding on tight with their grips, but they're soft with the rest of their body.
So they can read.
Like, they can read, yeah. Too often we've just got a culture of so stiff in the arms that we're just not getting any feedback from it.
Right.
From that grip. If you're kind of loose, and it's just like a principle in life, you've got to be, you know, kind of soft and flexible, like, to be able to allow new information to come your way. You know, if you've got a rigid mind, you're not open, you know. What do we say when someone who's got a flexible mind is someone who's open-minded, is getting more information, is allowing, you know. Yeah. And that's what we've got to kind of demonstrate on the mat.
I'm just trying to think of ways that you could train something like reactions and having that feeling through the arms rather than just relying on pure strength. Have you ever trained with your eyes closed? Like, not full randori, of course.
But yeah.
Like drills and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I did it.
Of any benefit?
I did it last night in my class. It was actually me as a partner with my eyes closed. And it was purely for the fact that even at my level, I'm still anticipating steps that aren't giving my partner the normal reaction. So I will close my eyes so that I will step a little bit more general, like, so he can work off that rather than me anticipating his foot sweep coming, something like that. Yeah, you've got to have these sort of measures or drills in place. But like I said, if you can cut back the randori to make it less strength-based, a lot of things happen in that time. Again, not being afraid to be thrown, not being afraid to lose, or, you know, and I say lose in inverted commas, but all of this takes place is that, you know, there's a lot of ego going around, people too much caught up in the past or the future.
Yeah.
They're either worried about what happened before, or they're worried about if they're going to win or not, or, you know, there's all these different types of constraints. And I think we've got to embrace that. We're so lucky in judo to experience that. We've got to realize that that's an opportunity that we can work with. You know, we don't get too many opportunities in life where we can experiment and play around with our ego and let go and feel and things like that. And judo is an opportunity for that. And we've got to embrace it rather than being so caught up in, like, I don't want to be thrown, and being so tight and rigid.
Yeah.
You know, it's an exploration.
It's great for, I suppose, the majority of listeners will be on a competitive aspect, to be able to hear people who have been through all that and can say, there's a lot of enjoyment in judo, and you sort of have to embrace it while you're there.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's so much there, and it can be lifelong. That's been the changing point. It's been the changing point with how I maintain my body. You know, judo is a lifelong pursuit, and the more we kind of look at the long term, the healthier the pursuit is. You know, we need to maintain our bodies and our state of mind for, you know, as long as we can, and judo can help us do that. And I'm lucky that I've made the shift, and I look at judo differently, and, you know, I plan to be doing what I do, you know, for a long time.
Great. Well, I think that's a good place to end it. It's a great takeaway point. And so thank you so much, Oren.
Thank you so much, Mel. It's been a pleasure.
So I hope you've enjoyed listening to that two-part series from Oren Yaniv. As you can tell, he speaks from a lot of learnings and a lot of experience. So if you haven't heard the first part of the interview with Oren, I definitely recommend that you go back and listen to that. Otherwise, thank you for listening to the Judo Edit podcast. I really appreciate all your comments and feedback. Continue to share and subscribe and tell your friends. And otherwise, it's been a pleasure having you listen. This is Melissa Budiato signing off.